Hello and welcome to the Affairs Current Podcast. My name is Carter Vance, your host as always. Our email is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com. Our blog, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com, where you can find all the show notes. We've taken a little bit of a hiatus, had some ups and downs recently, but we are going to come back to you with an episode that I hope is really going to bring an interesting perspective on a conversation that is being talked about quite a lot in North American media, but maybe not in ways that are necessarily representative of the people most affected by it. So we're going to be talking, as we have on a few previous episodes, I'm lucky enough to have some guests that I think are going to bring a very interesting perspective on the Korean Peninsula, and more specifically, recent events surrounding both the relationship between North and South Korea, but also between the South Korea and America. And of course, we say this a couple weeks away from on June 12th, supposedly the long-promised and long-awaited, I suppose, summit between North Korea and America, between the leaders Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. So we're going to get into all of this today with some people that I think are going to bring a really interesting perspective from the Republic of Korea and, you know, maybe dig into some aspects of this issue that aren't being fully aired in the mainstream media right now. But I'll let everybody introduce themselves. So firstly, I have Alex.
Hi, sure.
Alex, do you want to introduce yourself?
I am a graduate student in international relations at the Graduate School of International Studies in Yonsei University in Seoul, currently in my last semester.
Right on. And Alex has appeared previously on the podcast talking about both topics related to Korea and East Asia, but also some other things as well. And I have another returning champion, I guess.
Sure.
Junte, do you want to introduce yourself?
South Korean, currently an English teacher in high school, and also activist, and also studied sociology at Seoul National University. That's about it.
And my new guest here is James.
Sure.
James, yep. You want to introduce yourself?
James from the United States and Korean Studies major here at Yonsei.
I've been living in Korea for about almost 7 years now, so I can bring hopefully a unique perspective of a foreigner who's seen some of the events between South, North, U.S., and the region unfold over the years. So hope to
Right on. So I guess the first question that I want to ask is, so we're coming into this, you know, obviously there's, a huge history and backstory on the Korean Peninsula that we could, you know, spend all day talking about. But I want to talk about some of the recent events first. So the first thing that I want to talk about is this recent summit between the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, and the president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, that happened recently. Now, the way this got portrayed, at least when I was reading about it in, you know, New York Times, whatever, is this is a big breakthrough. This is a historic meeting. They've agreed to, you know, eventually broker some kind of formal peace agreement that would actually end the Korean War, because for those of you who don't know, the Korean War has never actually officially ended. There was an armistice agreement, but not a formal peace agreement. So that was the big takeaway that came out of it, at least on this side of the pond, I guess. But what I did also read later was that was maybe a little bit of a misinterpretation, or there were different feelings about this in South Korea. The language that was used in the agreement is not quite what was portrayed maybe in the media. So I guess the first question I want to ask, and anybody can answer it and then we'll kind of get talking, is so what was kind of the general feeling in South Korea about this summit and what came about it? Do people think this is a big breakthrough, or do people think, you know, we should wait and see, or is there a divide in society about it? What's the feeling over there?
I don't know. Should I go first? As a Korean, it's a major breakthrough in different ways. Physically, it's the first time ever a North Korean leader actually came to South Korean territory. Not only that, we are about to witness so many first ever things in history in the over 7 years of division. And I think apparently there is a mix of skepticism and hope and positivity up in the air. But I think overall, it's a lot of people are thinking that the law will actually change. We actually witnessed this around 15 years ago when we had the first two Korea summit talk. At that time, it was the first ever time the two leaders actually talk.
And that was Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il at the time, right?
At the time, and also, technically speaking, I think the official joint statement release is actually really, really inclusive of all the stuff that was talked about before that was signed, which actually didn't go into effect. So it's also very in detail as well. If you actually look into the whole statement, it's actually really long compared to the other ones. The first statement between the two leaders was actually less than probably 10 sentences. It was really abstract. It was really basic. It's very kind of like rudimentary, so to speak. But this time, we're talking about specific regions, specific measures they can take about a bigger picture. So I think there's a lot of people are thinking that, you know, just Kim Jong-un, he was portrayed as some sort of, many ways, almost like Trump, another dead man up in the north in our peninsula. That's what the media has been portraying him in ever since his inauguration in late 2011. But they were seeing him talking. It was actually my first time seeing him and hearing him talking. We always, you know, indirectly saw, you know, heard that he said about this and that, about about South Korea or the U.S., but this is our very first time to hear him talk, so it's a very big thing, and a lot of people are very hopeful about that.
Okay, and do you, Alex or James, do you have anything that you want to add to that? Is that your feeling as well, or do you disagree a little bit?
No, I agree. Of this declaration was much different than previous declarations made, I think, and there have been some kind of, you know, points laid out that I think point in direction that go into further development. And what's key this time is that in the joint declaration, they placed a lot of emphasis on total denuclearization, and not only that, but finally coming to conclude a peace treaty over the Korean War that has, you know, still in effect, as you mentioned earlier, technically. So, and one of the important things they mentioned there was the necessary involvement of not only, you know, the South and North, but the United States and China as well as major participants in the Korean War. So, and in terms of how this meeting has been presented in the media and the image that both the nations tried to represent there, I think the atmosphere was much more casual, much more jovial, pleasant, and we saw the two leaders interact in a way that you wouldn't expect to see in any other situation, and that we didn't see in the previous meetings.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask Alex this question, because I know that from previous discussions that we've had about the Korean Peninsula on this podcast, you know, we've kind of talked about the divisions in South Korean society between, you know, conservative and maybe more liberal or progressive sides. I guess, have you seen in the reaction to these talks that kind of difference? Are there some people who are saying, you know, that this is appeasing the North, we shouldn't be doing this, this is a bad direction to go? Is there a divide about this, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Certainly the leadership of the Liberty Party of Korea, which is the rebranded conservative party of the disgraced former President Park Geun-hye, has been reticent to endorse this peace initiative. One prominent line of criticism has been that the summit was stage managed to look perfect, and that it is timed for upcoming assembly elections. And so there's a lot of politicking for the domestic constituency in South Korea, and this is one of the driving forces behind the peace talks. So any moment like this, I think, when you see a kind of hint of detente between North and South, the old divisions come out of the woodwork. But it's important to note that if we're talking about the liberty of Korea, for example, there is also a divide in terms of generational support for these political parties. And the most prominent criticisms of the summit that I've seen have been lobbed by either politicians or their supporters who tend to be more advanced in their years. Younger people, my colleagues in the graduate school who are of Korean lineage, tend to be more hopeful. That's not to say that there aren't some legitimate concerns about the peace process going forward. That's not to say that there weren't some sort of very vague statements in the Panmunjom Declaration, which is a three-page statement that was released at the end of the North-South Summit. But again, a lot of this is being criticized more along partisan lines, I think, than anything else.
So you would say in that respect that the maybe the criticism is, as you say, political and maybe a bit generational as well. And I guess maybe one quick follow-up there, though, is you say that, you know, it might be done through domestic political consumption. So I guess what I kind of take from that is that, you know, would I be wrong in saying that overall South Korea, the South Korean populace is supportive of this initiative? Because if they're doing it and, you know, stage managing it in a way that makes it look successful, obviously that would communicate to me that, like, achieving a peace agreement is something that, you know, as a general statement, we could say the South Korean populace would like to do, and that they would support a party that is going to make that happen. Am I wrong in saying that, or?
Aside from the support of the peace process, which there certainly is, it's important to underscore the overwhelming mandate that President Moon received in last year's spring elections. Virtually every municipality in every region in the country, except for the conservative stronghold of Daegu, which is where a line of Korean military dictators and their descendants have come from, voted for the Democratic Party. And part of that mandate included a peace initiative aimed towards the north. I would remind the audience that President Moon had initially said that the first place that he would go would be Pyongyang, not Washington. So this has existed, I guess, in some form or another since the election, and that was the mandate that the government was elected on to act on. And more generally, there is, as of the latest polling, pretty widespread support amongst the Korean population and hope about this latest development in terms of peace talks.
I would also add to that recent polls have shown that even Liberty Party conservative supporters show a majority supporting the Panmunjom Declaration as well, so I think that's significant.
Yeah. And there is a cleavage within the Liberty Party of Korea. From what I've heard, at least some backbenchers or less prominent individuals in the National Assembly criticizing the leadership for being lackluster in their embrace of this latest detente with the North.
Right. A lot of the leaders of the Liberty Party have been in the party for quite a few years now and are getting on in their years. And they come from a political culture that was very reliant upon using the North as sort of... As a foil
Well, it's almost like something that they could bring up as a scare tactic for the populace, like, oh, you know, if you vote for these other guys, these liberals, the North is just gonna, you know, hammer them, and we need to be strong and stand up to the North. Is that kind of what their
right.
pitch
they,
was?
They're actually kind of dependent on the existence of the North to use as a threat to scare the populace into voting for them. It's not a tactic that really works with a lot of people anymore. It does with some, but as the population gets exposed to media and the older population that
I think they're kind of realizing that, you know, like that there's a history of almost like over 50 years of using the North as an excuse to get support for the Conservative Party. So it's been so egregious almost in the 80s and even the 90s. People say that there was democracy in South Korea. They were still really, you know, they can be called in all the time, you know, as a reason to ask the constituents to vote for them. But now the candidates are realizing the leader, what their party leaders are doing is not really helping that anymore, even in the conservative regions. So it's actually a pretty big change, because even my, you know, my people, like my parents or people around the generation in the 70s, we still have a pretty big portion of that generation, and then there's like they can't really talk about that too openly. Probably they kind of think that what if North does this and that, you know, like what if they, you know, like betray us and stuff like that. They're kind of scared about that, and but they can't really talk openly. I think it's more about the atmosphere that is changing.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So the question I and you did kind of allude to this earlier, but the question that I would kind of ask about that is, what do you think makes this summit different from previous summits that have happened between the North and South Korean leadership? Because we have seen, you know, and this is why some people were kind of skeptical about what was going to come out of this, was because we have seen, you know, moments like this before. Like we mentioned earlier, you know, the Sunshine Policy in the early 2000s, that was, you know, kind of generally seen to be a failure overall because of, you know, whatever set of reasons we could give for that. And there have been, you know, moments of bilateral meetings that have occurred before that have had declarations that have come out of them. I guess the question I would ask is, what makes this situation different? And are there reasons to believe that the outcome of this overall will be more successful than those previous attempts have been? Anybody can answer that.
Well, so I think one important factor here to recognize is that as much as we might regret to say it, I think the fact that I don't know where to go with this.
Well, just to point out one small obvious point, the previous peace talks have always involved North Korean leaders receiving South Korean presidents or officials. And it was very significant and difficult to overstate the importance of the North Korean leader stepping onto South Korean soil to meet with the South Korean leadership and engage in direct talks. So that's certainly one factor, I think, that sets this apart from previous talks. And I think that that is in part reflective of the fact that the stakes are much higher now in 2018, I think, than they were in the 90s or in the early 2000s. And I think that sense of political urgency is in part responsible for the willingness both of the United States to deal directly with the North Koreans, and also for the North Koreans to come for the first time to talk with the South Koreans on their own territory.
Just to add a little bit about what Alex talked about is, you know, at first he talked about North Korean leader coming to South Korean territory. I kind of wanted to probably, when I talk about North Korea, I think I assume that even if the South Koreans, I would disagree a lot, or probably more so with foreign views. But what I want to say about North Korea is that they have been almost like porcupine, really. They're kind of scared to come out. They were not confident to come out, but this time they were actually coming out, even though they have consistently tried to talk with the U.S. and, you know, normalize their relations with the U.S. and other countries, because that's actually crucial for that. But this time, a lot of people are saying, like, oh, is it a little bit similar to the first summit talk, or is it like the six-party talk resolution they made in 2005, or is it just completely different, or is it kind of like even, you know, closer to the 1994 talk between Kim Il-sung, grandfather of Kim Jong-un, and Jimmy Carter, proved a threat to Pyongyang at the time to stop the nuclearization of North Korea. People are talking so much about that. Where is that coming from? It feels kind of different. As I said, a lot of people feel pretty optimistic, but they can't really say what it really is. But what I'm trying to point out here is that probably it might sound a little bit odd to some people, but I think complete development of nuclear nuclear program in North Korea is actually really, really complete game changer, I think. Because, you know, if you actually see the all development of talks and, you know, diplomacy, and this year, even from January 1st, it actually all initiated by North Korea. And then if you actually see the talk going on, you know, even quite relevant to this week, the way they carry their conversation indirectly and, you know, to the media and whatnot, you can feel that actually, it's almost like a David and Goliath between, you know, North Korea and the United States, because if you actually see the history, it was so obvious that, you know, completely during the Korean War, the U.S. Military shattered the whole territory, and then their North Korea is so scared of the same thing happening anytime in the future, because even though we don't really feel that, they are able to feel them, and whenever we had the drills and whatnot, they actually, on a daily basis for the civilians, they experience that impact. So for them, I think that complete development of nuclear programs is actually a big game changer, and I think that's the main reason for this development.
So if I can just maybe clarify that slightly, so if I understand you correctly, what you're kind of saying is that the fact that North Korea has this nuclear capacity has maybe allowed it to feel confident enough to come out and, you know, ask for these direct talks and set up these kinds of diplomatic measures, because they feel that they have enough, let's say, military protection that if things go completely south, they're not just going to be bombed back into the Stone Age.
I wanted to add to that in terms of the position that the North Koreans are coming from. If we look at the regime specifically, I think it's also clear that it is more secure now, or at least feels more secure now than it has in the past. And this was indicated at first by Kim Jong-un's historic visit to China last month. The fact that that was his first trip, even though he came to power after his father Kim Jong-il's death in late 2011. This was the first time. And the logic has been sort of that previously he was unable to leave, maybe because he had not solidified his position with the elites or with the North Korean population. The fact that he is now left, not only to China once, but twice, and also to South Korea, sort of indicates the increased legitimacy or stature that he has at home. And also to underscore the point Junte has made about the nuclear part of the equation, Kim Jong-un's hallmark policy has been something called Byongjin Doson, which means basically like the two-line or two-track policy. And that was simultaneous nuclear development, which we hear a lot about, and then the second part of the equation, which is not paid attention to even in the South Korean media that much, economic construction. Most recently, Kim Jong-un has come out saying that the nuclear program is now complete. Now, what's the other part of the equation that hasn't been discussed? Is that he then announced, now our focus will solely be on socialist economic construction. So it's gone from a two-track policy to a one-track policy, which means that Kim Jong-un is now staking his legitimacy or the aim of his government on further economic development. And obviously, if he's stating that the nuclear part is done and then indicating his willingness to engage in peace talks and saying that his concern is more economic development, then there could be more of an alignment of interest between perhaps the United States and South Korea and North Korea, if there can be a consensus that from now on the main concern in North Korea going forward, if we can handle the security issue, is not going to be further, you know, nuclear development or something like that, but a focus on the economic reality inside North Korea.
And just to maybe nail that down a little bit, and I don't know if you can speak to this, but what I kind of hear from that is something to this effect of like, okay, I finished a nuclear program, now I'm willing to talk, and I want to do economic development. So obviously part of that is getting some kind of relief from the sanctions that North Korea is under and an ability to do business with the outside world. But I also wonder, has he indicated like a willingness or a direction to kind of do sort of reforms in the model of like a Deng Xiaoping or moving in that direction, or when he says socialist economic construction, like what does that actually mean?
That's interesting. Certainly a lot of time has been spent, perhaps wasted, trying to dissect Juche, like the ideology of self-reliance, which is sort of the mantra of the DPRK. And I'm certainly not a North Koreanologist who can speak to the intricacies of the rhetoric being used up north. But this is another issue that I'm not sure has been given a lot of attention. Aside from Kim Jong-un's two visits to China, this past week, provincial and municipal level officials from the Korean Workers' Party visited China specifically to explore and learn about China's experiments and experience with opening up and reform, and basically the marketization of the Chinese economy. And they explicitly stated that they were there to learn under guidance from Kim Jong-un as well. So obviously the fact that they're there on a visit to China has been sanctioned by the regime. There's no doubt about that. But it's interesting to note that not only are they learning while they're in China about China's experience with marketization, but they've been instructed to by the leadership. So that indicates at the highest level some interest in learning from the experience of the Chinese communist regime and how they've been able to open up their economy more to the world.
Absolutely. Okay, so, and I think we've started touching on this question, but I do want to address it more directly. So what in your opinion has been the reasons for this thawing in the relations, this ability for people to come together? Because sometimes, you know, when we read about this, at least when I read about this, a lot of the talking points, well, it comes down to the individual personalities. People say, oh, because Moon is like this and because Kim Jong-un is like this, therefore they're able to work together in a way that other people maybe aren't. And then, you know, even it extends to Trump. Oh, because Trump is this way, he's able to get things out of North Korea that other people haven't. Or because he's, you know, unconventional, I guess would be the word for it, he's willing to sit down with them or whatever. I guess the question is, how much truck do you put with the idea that this is about the individual personalities versus what do you think are the structural factors that are leading to this moment? Anybody can answer that.
You touched on some of the structural factors earlier in terms of North Korea's desire to perhaps engage with the world in terms of its economic development. But I think we can't disregard personalities of the individual leaders as well. Obviously, Trump is someone who's not so path-dependent as other leaders might be, and willing to explore new ways of negotiating. I mean, Trump is obviously known as, quote-unquote, the negotiator. And while some might see him as hawkish, and he definitely is in many ways, the fact that Trump seems to have personally invested himself and his personality into these negotiations, I think we can be safe to assume that regardless of what kind, we don't know exactly what kind of outcome or a deal might look like, but it seems that Trump has invested himself into the idea that there will be some kind of agreement, perhaps some kind of movement towards negotiating an end to the Korean War, finally. Of course, you know, this is all prognostication at this point, but in terms of personalities of the three individual leaders, there's some hope there. We could also dissect Kim Jong-un as well. Unlike his father and his grandfather, who spent all of their time in either Korea or Moscow, Kim Jong-un and his was educated abroad and in many ways experienced sort of a westernized consumer lifestyle while he was being educated in Switzerland. So if we look at that, we can perhaps see that Kim Jong-un might be willing to explore new options in terms of economic developments and negotiating in ways that are also not as path-dependent as perhaps those surrounding him in the regime and his predecessors.
For the diversity of discussions, I actually thought that this is the most important question out of the whole talk today.
Okay.
I think not only the personalities, I'm quite interested in more structural views and structural theory. So usually when I was in sociology, I was always studying war systems analysis, and I personally want to see this event from that perspective. Probably it's going to be a little bit contrary to what James just said, but I just kind of view all these three actors and even Trump's unexpected personality as pretty irrelevant in a way, because I see this almost as dismantling of the U.S. hegemony and also their influence in East Asia, because as I said once before, it was kind of a fight or a talk between porcupine and a human being. You can just easily dissect the other. So for the reason structural factors at play that influence these two main talks, I think are mainly three things. As I said earlier, complete development of nuclear program is one thing. For that, they need three things to actually threaten the U.S. to actually come to the stage to talk with North Korea. First thing is nuclear weapon development. Second thing is miniaturization of nuclear weapon. The third thing is having ICBM and put the miniaturized nuclear warheads on the missiles, because it's more than 8,000 miles away from North Korea. But the thing is that till very recently, they actually came up with all these technologies, which actually only 9+1 countries have before. So it's, as I said, it's a big game changer. And then I think from that, Kim Jong-un and North Korean regime got a lot more confidence to go out to the international politics and talk with them and, to be able to bargain with them. So I think it's one of the biggest factors. And second thing, as Alex mentioned earlier, a little bit some domestic reason in South Korea is that, we have this South Korea has been almost like a battlefield of Cold War over 70 years. So kind of the McCarthy era sort of ideology is still working here. So as long as you tag somebody as a communist supporter or a communist empathizer, it can be easily, maybe it's almost end of their social life. So I'm kind of a little bit, as a South Korean citizen, I'm kind of like wary of that as well. But we had this hope that we, 2 years ago, we had this crazy candlelight protest of over, for one protest, we more than 1 million people gathered together to impeach the president, and a lot of things changed after that. And Moon Jae-in administration is actually, getting that sort of expectation that he has to do something in terms of peace and other issues as well. So I think this factor is at play as well domestically in South Korea.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, I just want to say one thing quickly and then I'll throw it to you, Alex. Because I remember when, because it was you, Jintae, and I, and Alex talked about right after Moon Jae-in had won the presidency, and, both, I think we all kind of agreed that there were, reasons for optimism, but also reasons for skepticism about what was going to happen next. I do definitely think that one of the factors that you can't ignore here is the domestic political situation in South Korea. And, is that moment where you do have all these people getting out on the streets and protesting Park Chung-hae, and she ultimately does get impeached. you know, is that the moment where this all starts to kind of fall into line? Because people, maybe that's the moment where people start to get out of this old way of thinking almost, because, I mean, she is almost this very symbolic representation of that, being the daughter of the you know, the former military dictator of Korea. But anyway, Alex, if you want to follow on that, or if you have something else you'd like to say.
Well, I mean, to touch briefly on the most recent issue that you raised, I think in many ways this candlelight revolution was a watershed in Korean history.
Which was led by you personally. We sent you down there and you destabilized the South Korean government.
It was my attendance there was actually, I think, illegal under South Korean law, given the student visa, which is another conversation we can have for a moment.
Okay, we can edit that out if that would jeopardize anything.
Like, edit me out of the photo. I think one of the reasons why it was a watershed moment was because it wasn't composed of this sort of organized labor activist class exclusively. It succeeded in mobilizing huge swaths of the population, including large numbers of young people who in South Korea, like in many other developed countries these days, are blamed for being apathetic, not voting, not being engaged. They were incredibly present in those movements. You couldn't miss them. And so this, not only the ability to connect with a much larger, previously depoliticized swath of the population, but also to mobilize the upcoming generation of people who are going to be the voters for the next, you know, century or so. For that reason, it was important. But if I could just briefly go back to the question about systemic versus personality-driven factors, I think I see points on both James and Junte's side. I think Junte is right in highlighting the obviously strategic factors at play, the geopolitical factors, the fact that North Korea now has not only nuclear capability, but the delivery system in order to land weapons of mass destruction on the American continent. Certainly that things were taken up a notch, obviously, when they said that they had the capability to attack Guam, and that's when the war of words really started escalating. But I think personality is also important. If we look back earlier in the Cold War, there was this great debate about the loss of China and in the United States, which was especially ginned up by McCarthyism. And the idea was that China was now lost to the communists, that China was a puppet of the Soviet Union, and that, you know, Yugoslavia notwithstanding, the communist world, the second world, was basically a monolithic mass. And it took Nixon and Kissinger to actually realize something that there had been evidence of throughout the 50s and the 60s, which was that there was a cleavage, and there was that cleavage between the PRC and the USSR could be exploited to the Americans' advantage, right? So there wasn't, at the moment that Nixon came to power, some sort of geopolitical reality that suddenly manifested itself. Rather, there was an opportunity that Nixon really was the first important person in the United States to see and had the political will and plan to exploit, along with Kissinger, right? So similarly, you could say that, yes, for these systemic or material reasons, the timing is perfect, or the timing requires some sort of diplomatic confrontation or resolution between the United States and Korea. But at the same time, personal factors are important. And to just give like a few quick examples, in both the United States, as James mentioned, but also as in North Korea, I think that the domestic legitimacy of the leadership is tied to some sort of desirable outcome of these talks in a way that it hasn't been previously. I think Kim Jong-un, compared to his father and grandfather, is much more of a personal leader. First of all, just in terms of his personality, his style is much more like that of Kim Il-sung. He's more warm. He's more charismatic. He emphasizes more people-to-people contacts, giving public speeches, visiting public places. But on the other hand, because of the calamities in North Korea that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union, the famine, the economic devastation, the legitimacy of the North Korean regime now rests much more on Kim Jong-un's shoulders in terms of what he is able to deliver. And every single step in this summit talks and diplomatic initiatives has been covered in the North Korean media. And if the results are not good, it's not going to be good for Kim Jong-un. Again, as I said, having fulfilled the nuclear component of his government's policy, he's now solely focused on economic development. And if you talk to North Koreans and also people who have left North Korea who are now in China or South Korea, they emphasize how the regime's legitimacy is now connected to economic performance. And of course, relief from sanctions or some sort of economic development is contingent on a successful outcome in the peace talks. So, you know, we already know that Trump as well has a big stake in this in terms of his domestic constituency. He needs a win. So I think you can make the personality-driven argument that both Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump have a personal stake in seeing these summits successful.
And just to maybe add one quick thing on there, you know, when you mentioned about the famine in the 90s and stuff like that, because it's at that point where, and I can't remember what the Korean word for it is, but that's when Kim Jong-il orients the military first policy, which is, you know, very much, you know, the idea of build up the military, we should direct necessary resources to the military, and really the domestic legitimacy of the regime, you know, starts to rest much less on any kind of idea of economic development or prosperity, but rather this idea that we need a strong military because we're threatened from these outside powers, and we should direct as much of our resources as we can to that in order to protect ourselves. So I guess the question I would ask is what you're saying previously, is that a fundamental change in the relationship that the North Korean state has with its citizens and what it views its legitimacy is coming from, if they are going to focus on economic development?
Well, to answer very quickly before others weigh in, certainly the economic devastation and also the strategic consequences of China's opening up and reform and the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s, early 90s, the economic devastation that wrought in North Korea led to a collapse in large measure of the state capacity of the North Korean regime and its ability to live up to its end of the bargain, which was that it would rule in return, it would provide public goods to the people. And the public distribution systems collapse and the collapse of the state sector led to a grassroots marketization in North Korea, which hasn't really been discussed that much in foreign media. The character of the North Korean society today is such that most people do not depend on the public distribution system for their nutrition. Most people or a relative of theirs, they're dependent directly or indirectly on market activity, either state partnership with private actors or purely private actors. But you're right to point out that in the 90s, in the wake of that collapse of the the civil service in North Korea, Kim Jong-il invested all of his legitimacy in the military through the Songun policy.
Songun, that's what it is.
Kim Jong-un, I think it would be accurate to say, has sort of reversed that policy. Basically, the military first policy involved de-emphasizing the importance of the Korean Workers' Party and lifting up the importance of the military. But now, for the reasons that I've alluded to, because of the central importance of delivering on economic development and basic goods for the people, I think that, and with the announcement now of the completion of the dual-track policy, it's not just that, you know, we're pursuing nuclear weapons and growth. It's the nuclear weapons portion is done. Now growth is our main focus. But one final point on the dual-track policy, even then, you could make the argument that the emphasis on asymmetric capabilities represented by this drive for nuclear dependence is a recognition of the fact that given the increasing gap in development and capabilities between the South and North, it was no longer tenable to bolster the military so much. Because North Korea still has the largest military budget in the world, but of course its armed forces would not be successful against the South Koreans, certainly not against against the United States. The biggest budget in terms of proportion of their GDP, right?
So
you could say that the dual track policy and the drive for nuclearization was actually a recognition of that fact, and that the limited resources that were left should be devoted towards the people and the economy rather than this outsized military that the regime couldn't afford to continue supplying. And even if it did continue, it wouldn't have limited strategic benefit for them.
If I add a little bit to that, if you actually see the trend of military budget spending of North Korea, it actually has been pretty, especially if you actually really compare the military spending compared to GDP, it's actually pretty consistent over almost actually since late 60s. They had to actually increase their military spending with the a lot more U.S. forces in South Korea, and they witnessed internationally the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s, and then they experienced the Vietnam War, and then they realized that they can't really get any military help from China or Soviet Union at the time, even though they were still getting some, you know, oil and some basic resources at the time. They knew that those forces are not like the U.S. Supporting South Korea at the time, so they started to increase their, or they were kind of forced to, because there's, even at the time, they were being threatened by the U.S. Nuclear warheads in Japan, South Korea as well. So they had to increase the military spendings. And then, I think in the 90s, it's been more like a kind of like structural factor that made them emphasize more military spendings, because they, that's their strategy to survive, to have a bargaining sort of like a capability with military spendings. So I think they're sort of, their thought about economics and military has been pretty consistent, but it has sort of changed. Rhetoric has changed depending on the structural situation that they're faced with. So it's
Okay. Perfect. So now I want to move on, because we've kind of been talking about North Korea and South Korea. I want to address a little more directly the relationship, you know, let's bring the U.S. into this. So the question I have is, you know, a fairly straightforward one, which is, how do the people in South Korea feel about the Trump administration, and in particular, the administration's approach to Korea policy? Because, you know, he's made a lot of comments, and, you know, obviously he you know, is not maybe the most consistent person in the world in terms of what his ideas are, but he's made a lot of comments that are kind of like questioning the nature of the U.S.-ROK relationship, saying, well, you know, maybe it would be okay if we just gave Japan nukes, or maybe it would be okay if, like, we weren't spending so much on the military in South Korea, and, you know, South Korea needs to kick in more money for its own defense. Why are we protecting them? These kind of things, as well as his willingness to directly sit down with North Korean leadership. These are differences versus previous administrations. So I guess that's my first question here is, how is that received in South Korea? What do people think about Trump in South Korea?
Well, in my experience and from several news reports, I've seen that there's a perception definitely that Trump is impulsive, especially when he was first elected. I think the overall response was cautious, negative, perhaps even pessimistic. But with what's been going on in terms of negotiations with the North the past few weeks, there's been a complete turnaround. And whereas Trump, I think, was had his approval ratings among Koreans was as low, or perhaps on par with Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister of Japan, it's actually taken off in recent weeks. And people are hopeful about the upcoming negotiations, I'd say. So at least with that, in terms of his rapprochement with the North, I would say he's getting some support from the
from most South Koreans.
Okay. I'll add a little bit about that, and probably the way Trump is received is pretty much the same internationally, and depending on their political orientation. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, when we had the last podcast just around a little bit more than a year ago, and we talked a little bit about Trump and the prospect in the future about the region as well, and I arguably say that there could be some positive change with him at play in the issue. And when I was talking about the same thing with other people, they were all pretty surprised to hear that from me. Like, are you supporting Trump or someone like that? Or do you think Trump's going to be better than possibly Hillary Clinton or the previous President Obama or any other, or even Sanders? But for me, it actually goes back to the previous question of what is the structural factors of these summit talks. I think the one thing that I didn't mention out of three is actually more structural, more US-based factor of US hegemony being weaker. I think actually Trump is very impulsive, but at the same time, I have thought that my opinion about Trump and his sort of attitude in relation to the East Asian region has been pretty consistent and didn't really change ever since his inauguration for me. And for example, Obama or the previous, the fact that he comes completely out of the establishment in the US politics, I think it's a big factor. So he doesn't probably think too much about, for example, like US, South Korea, and Japan military alliances. He thinks more about his personal probably profit or even say over the issue. He thinks as a business person or a negotiator, as people say. So he's kind of like a representation of U.S. sort of establishment or hegemony being weaker, and he's playing his own role as a personal as a personality. But at the same time, I think he actually shows that the U.S. and North Korea decide to sit on the same table and start to talk about resolving the issue in the peninsula, which is it's the first ever thing in the history of North Korea and South Korea. So I think a lot of people actually, for sure they want to, a lot of South Koreans are promising about the talk, and they think that it's going to, if that ever happens, they think that it's going to be a good thing. And at the same time, quite some people who are skeptical about Trump, things that they get pretty suspicious too. But at the same time, I personally think he is more like, as James said before, he's more like a negotiator, business person. So he wants to achieve something out of it. And I personally think he doesn't have too many other options to choose from on his table because he has another domestic election in November. So he needs to achieve something. It's pretty apparent that he can't really do much domestically, so he's definitely looking forward to getting something from the international politics. So I think all these kind of factors are actually affecting, personally and structurally affecting Trump, so that he can't really have other negative sort of options to choose from about the summit talk. That's what I kind of think about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess I'll throw to Alex about this. Is the idea of Trump and Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader and the American president, sitting down to talk, is that well received in South Korea? People think that's a good idea? They're supportive of it?
I would simply say that a lot of the opposition in the United States towards any sort of rapprochement with North Korea is driven by one of two things. Either one, personal animus and resentment for Donald Trump, which is coming from, people ranging from centrist liberals to right-of-center figures to self-identified progressives, or two, motivated by the sort of path-dependent figures that I've been alluded to previously, the sort of foreign policy, military, and political establishment
who are loath to in any way compromise, whatever that means, or make any sacrifice in the interests of peace with North Korea. Those factors don't appear to be really evident in South Korea, because the South Korean people don't have the same relationship with the U.S. president as the American people do. All of his domestic actions, his personal blunders, aren't really covered that much. And if they are, people just look at it as a source of amusement. It doesn't directly impact their lives. So it's much less of a personality-driven relationship that they have with the president. And I think to the extent that he is driving and facilitating rapprochement, talks with the North and a diplomatic solution to the nuclear crisis, they are more than willing to tolerate.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so, and I guess maybe a very quick follow-up on that is there any concern about his previous comments and such about the nature of the military alliance between South Korea and America? Is there concern that he would weaken that, or is there actually maybe from some think that that's a positive thing, that, you know, we need to get away from this very hard military alliance? Because I did read recently, and anyone can correct me if I'm wrong and I read it incorrectly, but one of the key advisors to President Moon Jae-in basically made a comment saying that, you know, we need to rethink the US-ROK alliance, and in the future we should look to other sources for our defense. We need to be stopped relying so much on the US, that kind of thing. I guess the question I would ask is just, is there concern about what his presidency is doing to that bilateral relationship at all?
I think regardless of whether or not some kind of troop drawdown, U.S. forces, and disengagement on the peninsula is likely or not, regardless of that, I think there is some concern, especially among conservatives, that there might be some kind of disengagement of the United States from the peninsula. But, I mean, in more recent years, not just among conservatives, but among the general public, though, I would say there's less of a concern about a U.S. disengagement from the peninsula.
Trump actually thinks of it as a more like a money game. You know, he's trying to get some domestic support from that issue, that international issue, that, had a deal with South Korea and that I reduced our spendings on our military troops abroad, stuff like that. But it's a really, really historical issue, and, you know, it's actually goes back to the United Nations command, which is actually the head of the U.S. forces in South Korea command at the same time. So it's a kind of very complicated picture historically at the same time. But I think probably my opinion might be really different from the general public's opinion, because they don't really feel that too much, the general public doesn't really feel too much about Guantanamo, for example, right? It's kind of something like that. So they don't probably take it too seriously. But, as I said earlier, this kind of military alliance between South Korea, the U.S., and including Japan as well, this is kind of like the bigger picture is actually in relation to before, in the past, before 80s, Soviet Union, and after 80s, China, right? So actually, Alex shed briefly light on U.S. normalization with China as well. At the time, I think they needed some sort of support from China, and then, you know, China and Soviet Union at the time in the late 60s and early 70s, they had some bouts going on between those two communist leader countries. So just like that, Trump doesn't really understand this whole sort of like geopolitical hegemonic picture. He doesn't care about that in a way. So the thing is that him being president is actually a really big sign that this U.S. hegemony is actually weakening down personally think. Either Bernie might be reshuffling that sort of establishment in a different way because he had been elected, I think. But Trump is also another person out of the establishment. So I think a lot of people don't really having this sort of like thought experiment. What if Hillary was elected as president? Should there be this kind of summit talk too? I don't personally think and I said before that it's not likely because she has been pretty aggressive. North Korea, which was State Department head, and you know some of the comments she made before, and you know if you actually see the Trump cabinet, a lot of people were worried when Mike Pompeo became State Department head, like, oh, he's such a hog, and you know Bolton is more like a dog. But look at what's really actually unfolding current week, and you know what's that?
Yeah.
I'm just interested in who thinks John Bolton is dumb. I think he's never met a country he doesn't want to bomb.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, that's sort of like, I think there was that worry that a lot of people probably have less knowledge of U.S. domestic politics and, you know, other countries. But at the same time, you know, Trump is completely out of the establishment, and what he's doing is completely about himself in a way, and his support, and his next election, presidential election, and stuff like that. So personally, and also even some people talk about Nobel Peace Prize and whatnot. So I think it's very kind of like a very out of the box direction that it's taking compared to the previous even Democratic president in the U.S.
But I guess kind of what I'm hearing from that is. You know, even if he's coming to this kind of, as you say, outside of the box thinking in a very cynical and, like, personally interested way, people are kind of willing to put up with that because it is leading to something that they consider to be a positive outcome, or at least a potentially positive outcome. Okay. Yeah. So I do have one question here left, and then we'll move on to some final thoughts. So we've kind of been talking about, you know, these different actors: the U.S., South Korea, North Korea, a little bit about Japan. We haven't really talked very much about China, and they're a big player in the region too. So I kind of want to ask a broad question here. What role do we see China playing in these recent events? And then where do we see the relationship of China going forward with both North and South Korea? Because, you know, traditionally, the statement that I've always read and, you know, the kind of conventional wisdom in North America is, well, China maintains North Korea as kind of a semi-client state because it wants a buffer zone between it and South Korea, which has U.S. troops in it, basically. But then recently, it seems like China was maybe putting a little bit more pressure on North Korea, saying, okay, you got to go to the table. And they actually cooperated with certain U.S. sanctions against North Korea at one point. So I guess my broad question is, you know, what's the role for China in all of this? And what's the relationship of China to the peninsula going to look like moving forward, in your opinion?
Well, that's an interesting question, right? Because as much as I agree with Junte about the advantages that present themselves with an anti-establishment figure in the White House, at the same time, it is important to go back to those systemic factors. And the reality is that China's rise is not perceived in a positive light by the United States. And if you look at the most recent super military base that the United States has built in South Korea, it's clear they have no intention of going anywhere. The controversy about one and a half years ago in regards to THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, which is a U.S. Missile defense system, which was deployed on the South Korean Peninsula, was met with screams of bloody murder by the Chinese, and they in turn sanctioned South Korea, who was sort of caught, as the saying goes, between these two whales. And there was only a resolution about that last autumn. But that episode is instructive because the missile defense system was purportedly there to defend U.S. facilities in South Korea and portions of the South Korean territory from the North Korean nuclear menace. But the reaction of the Chinese, the fact that the THAAD radar covered strategic Chinese assets in Manchuria was not an insignificant factor at all, right? And so the question becomes, in the wake of denuclearization or some sort of settlement with the United States, what is North Korea's relationship with China going to look like? What is North Korea's relationship with the United States going to look like in a future unified Korea or even a divided Korea where the North has normalized relationships with the United States? Will North Korea be just as concerned as the Philippines, Indonesia, Cambodia, Vietnam, and virtually every other country around China, including South Korea, about the potentials of a Chinese military superpower in their backyard? I don't have the answers to that question, but I think you're right to point out the strategic considerations that are at play when it comes to China. And at the beginning of the conversation, I had alluded briefly to some vague statements in the Panmunjom Declaration. There is one statement where they discuss the possibility of either trilateral talks between the two Koreas and the United States or the two Koreas, the United States and China. So even there, you see the kind of uncertainty about what China's role is going to be. And there's lots of speculations on all sides about whether China is now playing a constructive role. The most recent speculation I've heard is that part of the Korean withdrawal from the recent high-level meeting with South Korea and more barbed words directed against the United States was the product of Xi Jinping's encouragement to the North Korean leadership to be more aggressive in terms of standing their ground vis-a-vis the United States. So I can't comment on that because I don't know, but certainly it's a big factor that can't be ignored.
James?
I personally think, you know, the role of even almost like, we talked about some red scares in South Korea and Vietnam, and the role of North Korea in a way, or even South Korea, from history, people say that South Korea was almost like a bulwark against communism. And, you know, the reason why we were divided instead of Japan like Germany after the Second World War is because, you know, the U.S. Strategic geopolitical sort of like influence and their decision to have Japan as a as kind of a like a representation of a success of, capitalist democracy. So if you actually think about that, the role of North Korea, they always, you know, so both South Korea and the U.S. wanted them to be aggressive and almost egregious, almost like a evil, you know, always kind of like access all evil so that they can, you know, have the enemy to sell their weapons, to have some sort of ideological, cultural enemy against capitalist capitalist democracy that they're saying. So I think, I personally think, you know, China and North Korea will work really closely. You know, if you actually see the previous two consecutive visits of Kim Jong-un to China, it was actually pretty shocking. I was pretty surprised because he had made a really sudden visit before the main talks with South Korea, and also after South Korea's, after the talk with South Korean leader and before the talk with U.S. leader. So it's kind of a signal that they are, you know, working closely with China, but at the same time, signal to other countries that, you know, like, we're still close together and we're going to work closely in the future as well. So, and also China has very strategic, strategic importance with North Korea. So probably they're going to say that they hope to complete denuclearization in the peninsula, but at the same time, they are going to strategically using North Korea as a sort of a fulcrum to sort of to get they want to get from other countries like the U.S. or South Korea.
James, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, a lot of people in the U.S. seem to think that North Korea is merely a puppet of China, and I say that that's a complete false interpretation. That's all I really have.
Okay. So I'll move on now to just some final thoughts. So You know, we've kind of talked about a lot of different things about the future of the peninsula and what it looks like. You know, is there going to finally be a resolution to the Korean War? What's the nuclear situation look like? And I think we've had a good discussion. I want to throw it to all three of you, and we can go in order however you like, is, you know, maybe some concluding thoughts, what you think the future of the peninsula looks like. You know, how is this meeting on June 12th supposedly going to go? Is it going to be successful? What does success look like? You know, is Trump going to come out of the meeting going like, you know, I think Juche is fantastic and we should implement it in the United States. Why haven't we done that yet? You know, I guess just some final concluding thoughts on the future of the peninsula. Whoever wants to go first can go first.
Sure. I personally think if that actually happens, it's going to be a major, major thing. As I said, it's kind of a fight between Davis and Goliath, and, you know, they decided to meet together. It's actually a big change in sort of like international politics. It's, I think, one of the major changes in the East Asian region, I think. Korean Peninsula has been the area where Cold War started, before it started, and lasts after it's finished in other regions. So I think a lot of people, you know, it sounds pretty counterintuitive to say that, in a way, for North Korea to have that kind of regime, a lot of people call it dictatorship and whatnot, and also nuclear power, nuclear weapon program, it could be their own defense, in their own way of defense against some sort of intervention from other countries. But it's really surprising that they actually withstood all those, you know, after those 70 or so years, and they were able to sit down with, with the United States. It's actually a major lift, I think, for them to actually come to the main stage of international politics and have something and become a big player in the field. So I personally think if that happens, it's going to be a big thing. And I personally think Trump doesn't really have many options to go against it in a way, even though there was some skepticism or worry about the possibility of the meeting actually happening in June. But I think it's going to most likely happen, and it's going to change a lot of things in the region and the world and the way it looks in the world. So I can't really say too much about it. I'm quite hopeful about that, just like the last year when I talked about Trump, even though I know that he's a, you know, he's a horrendous person. we'll see about that.
Okay, Alex?
Well, I think as we had been discussing a few minutes ago, there are a lot of unknowns. You know, will North Korea actually denuclearize? What does denuclearization mean? Will some sort of end to the Korean War lead ultimately to unification? Will a unified peninsula mean more U.S. soldiers in Korea as a bulwark against China, or will it mean a withdrawal from China? What will the relationship of a unified Korea be to China? What will it be to the United States? And I don't think we have the time to get into those sort of broader geopolitical questions. All I'll say is that the peace process that we've seen starting with the Olympics up until now has seen a lot of firsts. It's the first time Kim Jong-un has left the country, the first time that he's visited China, the first time a North Korean leader has ever set foot on South Korean territory. And if the summit goes ahead on June 12th, and I think it will for the personal stakes that both Kim Jong-un and Trump have in the successful outcome. If that summit does go ahead, it'll be the first time a United States president meets with a North Korean leader. For all of those reasons, I think that this summit will be historic. The momentum, if it keeps building, will hopefully lead to some sort of settlement. But I don't think that it will be quick either. So people expecting that June 12th will mark this watershed and from then on everything will be easily resolved have some misplaced hopes. But there is reason for cautious optimism.
And finally, James.
Yeah, I'd say there's a lot of reason for optimism. But with regard to denuclearization, there's so much talk about complete denuclearization, and we don't really know what
that's going to look like, and if it's really even possible. The North is so far along in its nuclear weapons program, much further along than Libya was, and much further along than it was in the mid and late 90s. So any kind of inspection regime is going to have a limited effect. There will be no full dismantlement of the program, I believe, but the fact that they are engaging, both sides are engaging, and that there are talks continuing is a good indicator that there will be some future stability and perhaps normalization of relations of the North with the rest of the world. And that's, I think, the best we can hope for.
Okay, right on. Well, I thank all three of you for coming on here and discussing with me. It's always very interesting, and I thank you for coordinating time schedules with me. It's about 10 o'clock at night here. It's about 11 o'clock in the morning over in South Korea. So I thank you for indulging me. It's always a very interesting conversation, and I think we got a lot of very good perspective in here. I guess, do you have anything final you want to say just in terms of where people can find you on the internet if they'd like to learn more about the work that you're doing, or maybe just a final sign-off, anyone?
If they're able to read Korean, I could tell them my website address. But...
yeah, we can definitely put it on the blog, yeah. And I mean, some people may be able to read Korean, so if they would like to. We'll link to it on the blog.
Will I send you the link, or we'll just...
Yeah, send me the link, and then we'll link to it on the blog. But it will be on there.
I actually wrote my master's thesis on kind of like South North Korean for relations about North Korean human rights issues. So I know a little bit about North and South Korean issues, but not too much. When I do my activist work, it's usually about labor and they were very thinking in Korea and investigation about that. So I'm not high level sort of expert about it, but I think I tried to deliver as much as I could about sort of like how to view, because in a way North Korea has been demonized for the last few decades, and I think I really want to call for some sort of sober and sane understanding of the state, because if they're really sober, if they're really crazy, some hell place run by madmen for three generations, then how could they be able to withstand all the hostilities against so many countries, especially the U.S., and be able to develop the nuclear program and have a talk with U.S. presidents? So I think this podcast would be a good chance to.
Absolutely, and I definitely welcome that perspective. Alex, did you have anything you want to plug?
For those with access to the World Wide Web, I tweet sporadically at AlexHill_GPO, usually about Canadian politics or environmental issues, but I do occasionally tweet about East, Northeast Asia issues, so you can follow me.
Okay. And I think we've already linked on the blog, but we can definitely, if we haven't already, put on there. And James?
Well, if you're on the Facebook, you can find me. My last name's Flynn, Flynn.
Oh, and I would also point out that James recently published a very insightful analysis about cleavages in the Korean labor movement in the Park Chung-hee era. Mm-hmm. It was just published in the peer-reviewed South Korean Journal in English. Marxism 21, I believe, is the journal, so maybe we can...
Yeah, absolutely. Just send me the link and we can put it on the blog and maybe get it some more exposure. Okay, well, I thank everyone again for talking, and once again, our blog is the fairestcode.blogspot.com, where we'll have everything linked to that we talked about today, and our email is fairestcode@gmail.com, and for myself and for all three of my guest hosts, I thank you for listening, and I wish you a pleasant week.